Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film community where we make art house, indie, and classic cinema accessible to the masses. Today we are continuing Season 5, the Contemporary Asian Filmmakers season, and we are looking at a second film from Thai director Apichatpong Weerasethakul. Today's film is Cemetery of Splendor from 2015. This film won at the Cannes Film Festival. It's called the Uncertain Regard Award. It's not the top prize, but it's one of the notable awards that they give out every year, in addition to winning several other awards. So what is Cemetery of Splendor about? Well, here's the IMDb description. It says, a group of soldiers in a small town on the Mekong River in northern Thailand are struck with a bizarre sleeping illness. And that's really just kind of the tip of the iceberg with this movie. So I'm going to dive into it today with my season 5 guest, Omaya Jones, who is back again to follow up on last time's discussion of Uncle Boon Mi, who can recall his past lives. Omaya is a big movie fanatic and a film podcaster. He has helped curate the Arkansas Times film series here in Central Arkansas, which once included this film. So I'm sure he has some good things to say about it. Omaya, how are you today? And what have you been watching lately?
I'm doing great. And so this, since we recorded last time, I have actually rewatched the 2006 Miami Vice, just continuing my latest Michael Mann obsession. And I was even more taken this time by just the story as it pertains to Colin Farrell's Sonny Crockett and the character played by Lee Gong. Like that, it's that the romance and the way that portion of that story is shot is reminiscent of just like some sort of like European art film or something.
Wow.
And then I also watched a pair of movies this week from the 80s. One called Vibes by a director I was not familiar with named Ken Kwapis. And it's just this 80s screwball comedy with Peter Falk, Cyndi Lauper, and Jeff Goldblum, who can convene with spirits, and they go to South America in search of some gold.
Wow. And then it's quite a cast.
And then I also watched a film by Susan Seidelman, who's probably most known for Desperately Seeking Susan. But she made a film called Making Mr. Right, which is about this scientist who hires his ad agency to sell the idea of robotic space exploration. And the scientist is played by John Malkovich, and the robot that he creates is also played by John Malkovich.
Love it.
It's really funny and charming and very 80s. So
those all sound really interesting. It's funny that you bring up John Malkovich because I'm just probably going to mention him a little bit later because today's film reminded me of another movie that has him in it. Anyway, we'll get to that. The thing I watched recently, I watched the movie Pan's Labyrinth for the first time from Guillermo del Toro. And I really liked it. It wasn't what I thought. I thought it was like more of a scary movie, like more of a horror movie. It's really not at all. It's just like a dark kind of fairy tale. It's got some scary stuff in it. Got some really creatively designed monsters that are really creepy. But it's actually really... It's basically told from this little girl's perspective, and I don't know, it's really fantastical and fun, even though it's got some really heavy stuff in it too. And actually, it also had a little, I'm always like finding the connections between the things that I'm watching for the podcast and everything else. And there was a little bit, just a really kind of a mention, but I watched it shortly after I watched Cemetery of Splendor, and I was like, well, there it is again. And they were talking about reincarnation, and the lead girl in the story is supposedly the reincarnated version of a princess from long ago. And so she is, she's chosen. She's like sort of prophesied about, and that's why she's able to see the fairies and go on this kind of quest. Anyway, I really liked it. I still have some more Guillermo del Toro kind of blind spots to fill in, but this is a big one that I've always wanted to watch and finally knocked it out last night. Have you seen it before?
I have. I think that's awesome. You know, Guillermo del Toro to me is one of those directors that's just really enthusiastic about film in general. And especially like, I don't know if you've ever like seen any of his designs or like his Creature House or anything, but he just loves cinema and in particular, like horror cinema and fairy tales and listening to, like, I remember when I was in college, I had a friend who had, I think it was The Devil's Backbone, on DVD, and I remember like I was, you know, pulling an all-nighter or something one night, and I had that on, and just like the DVD commentary for that was almost like a film school. Like it was really wow. Involved in just sort of like the process of the creation and the writing and the history of like Spanish fairy tales and Gothic horror. And then they released another version on disc, I think by Criterion, with a completely different commentary with a completely different angle. And like one was really technical and one was less technical, but more sort of thematic. And he's like, just listening to him talk about film is one of my favorite things.
That's really cool. And so the only other film I've actually seen by him is Shape of Water, which was two or three years ago now. And yeah, there's some interesting similarities as far as, so it's not really a scary movie, but there's a monster or a creature. And then the lead characters are kind of, or the heroes of it, I guess, are all kind of marginalized people, whether they're women or like in Pan's Labyrinth, children. But then in Shape of Water, we have this gay man. And of course, Sally Hawkins is mute. And I don't know, just it shows these people who are marginalized and kind of pushed out, outcasts sort of, that end up making the biggest difference and kind of fighting the system a little bit. And I thought I liked that about it. So I'm curious to watch more of his films and see if that's something that he does a lot.
So you haven't seen Pacific Rim?
Oh, yes, Pacific Rim. That's the only other one. Yeah.
I was going to say, like, I just remember, like, some of the promotional material for that. He's used this phrase that I think about all the time where he talks about, he says there's no eye candy in his film. It's eye protein. And so, you know, like, he's like a very visual director, and like everything is contributing to the telling of the story in some way. And I think not everybody can do that.
Yeah.
But like he really can, you know,
synthesizing the two in a really good way. I remember hearing about Pacific Rim that when he was writing it, he watched a lot of sports movies, which I thought was so interesting. Is that it's because he wanted it to be about teamwork, like that, because the two pilots inside of the machines have to work together. And I thought that's interesting, but that movie has some really amazing visual moments too. And anyway, yeah, I did forget that one, but I haven't seen Kronos or either of the Hellboy movies. So I have some more Guillermo del Toro things I need to knock out, but I guess I've seen those three now. Well, all right, let's get on into our discussion of this week's movie, which is Cemetery of Splendor.
ดวงวิญญาณของพระราชาสมุนันน่ะกำลังดูดเอาพลังจากทหารสมุนินีล่ะไปเหตุการณ์สู่รบ
Okay, let's talk about Cemetery of Splendor. So this is, again, directed by Pichitpong Weerasethakul, and he is a Thai director, and he makes these really kind of, now having seen two of them, kind of slow, meditative films, and this one is similarly mysterious, I would say, to last time's Uncle Boon Mi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives, but a bit more straightforward, and I definitely connected with it a little easier. Here's a quote, actually. You go to the Rotten Tomatoes page, they have these little kind of catch-all quotes and or just like a little kind of description of generally what people think of this. But I thought this sentence kind of summed it up pretty well. It says, Cemetery of Splendor gracefully eludes efforts to pin down its meaning while offering patient viewers another gently hypnotic wonder from writer-director Pichitpong Weerasethakul. So I think that puts it well, that what does this movie mean? It's very open to interpretation, I would say. I think if you say you have the definitive answer on anything, that I might balk at that a little bit, because it's such a open-ended, mysterious kind of a movie. But I found it really moving, which I can't say exactly about Uncle Boon Mi. I definitely enjoyed it, and I think that I found a lot to ponder after the fact. But I didn't feel super emotional about it while I was watching it, which in this one I did have some moments that of kind of pathos that I found pretty moving. So here's kind of generally what it's about. There's a hospital. It used to be a school. And then we find out later in the film that it used to also be a cemetery, or there's a cemetery beneath it. And the lead character is Jinjira, who goes by Jin. She works at this hospital. She's tending to, ends up being one soldier in particular who is there. So it's all these soldiers there, and mostly they're sleeping. Almost all the time they're sleeping. She's tending to this soldier. The soldier's name is It, I-T-T. And they form a kind of a mysterious connection, even though he's asleep for a lot of the movie. So that's kind of big picture, and we're going to get into more details. But Omaya, what is your kind of general impression of this film?
So this film is kind of special for me. It's one that we screened this last year in June. So I got to see this as part of the Arkansas Times film series with an audience.
Yeah.
And it's... To me, there's just something so nice and comforting about a film that just sort of allows you to sort of, it's relaxing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think when I first saw it, I'd seen Sinner's Been a Century, and I was just taken by a film that just sort of takes its time and allows you to sit with it and sort of take you to this a different part of the world. And then I was also just in sort of intrigued thematically, even though I didn't get at the time, I don't think, and I'm still not sure, completely sure about sort of all of the layers of depth and meaning and like in all of the various images, but it just like, it's just allows itself to be sort of a strange film. And I like to sit with it and be in this world for 2 hours. You know, there are things like the boats, you know, in between like the main scenes, there are these shots of things that are just happening within the confines of this village, whether it's just these chickens that roam around freely or these people hanging around at the lake and these, there's some sort of turbine motor things that are running. And there's just all of these things that are just part of this world that it builds.
Yeah. I was going to bring up the turbines, and then there's kind of repeated shots of those, and then of ceiling fans just rotating. And then also just like fans, I don't know, floor fans, like sitting up on stands, moving around. And there's a lot of really still shots. And so one of the recurring themes of this, I would say, is sleep. Sleeping is a big deal.
Yes.
And I know that's a big deal for the director as well. So in between these two episodes, I think you sent me an article about a special installation he did where basically he was encouraging people to watch the film, a super long, like 48 hours of footage of some kind that he put together. And you go into a special hotel kind of thing, and you're supposed to watch and sleep and watch, and like that's the experience. And he's tailoring the film somehow to a sleep dreamlike kind of quality to it. And I had that in mind, and with that in mind, I thought, like, it seems like with this movie he's almost daring us to fall asleep at certain points. Like I watched it late at night, but I mean, it was like 11:30 or something when it was close to the end. I actually did fall asleep towards the end, and I had to rewind and watch the rest. But it is so slow, and there's some of the shots are so drawn out that it really invites that. But sleep is also, so I want to say more about that, but let's talk about sleep in within the film. There's a lot going on with it. So there's the characters, a lot of the, so all the soldiers are almost always asleep, even as they begin to wake up here and there. Especially with the character that we are following the most is It. He will be awake and then just out of nowhere, in the middle of a sentence, just fall over asleep, like narcoleptic kind of feeling. And then there's also a lot made. So there's these machines too, which also visually are probably they're the sort of the symbol of this one. If in Uncle Boon Me we have the shrouded figure with the red eyes as kind of the symbol you think of, in this one it's going to be these sleeping machines, which they have these poles sticking up over each of the beds, and they emit these bright lights. It's green, it's blue, it kind of fades different colors, and having them all lined up in a room is really visually pretty stunning. And that's another recurring kind of visual thing we see. But then the machines, what they are doing, are supposed to help the soldiers to have better dreams. And so I kind of got a sense that dreams are maybe more spiritually important in the culture there than they would be in America. But so that was, I was kind of keying into that. And then there's a scene where there's like a meditation teacher of some kind, or I'm not clear exactly what his role is, but he leads this group of people on this kind of a meditation practice. But he also has a long spiel about, we think all the time, but when we're asleep, we think, and we call that dreaming, and we can't stop it. But then he has this meditation about gather the energy in your body, and now imagine it going out into the front yard, imagining it going out into space and expanding over everything, and then I'll suck it all back into your body, and this can be a really healing thing. And it was mysterious, and I was really intrigued by that. And it also, I don't know, that like it was almost the way it was presented, you could almost do that as a viewer. So I kind of tried to put myself in that headspace and kind of do this meditation thing. And I don't know, it's just interesting that a movie would go there. So anyway, yes, sleep is a big deal here. Do you have any other thoughts about the significance of sleep in the film, or to Weiris Athikul as a director?
Yeah, well, so one, I think that the meditation expert's monologue is sort of the closest thing to like an artist statement in the film. In an interview that I read, he talks about sort of like after doing the Primitive Project, he got really interested in sleep. And one of the things he talked about is the stages of sleep, and how according to his research, the sleep cycles run in these 90-minute cycles, and which is about the average length of a feature film. And so I have a quote here. I'll just read it. He says, as I researched sleep, I found that we sleep in intervals. The REM intervals loop several times a night. Each loop is about 90 minutes long, the same running time as the average feature film. So maybe running time of films fulfills our subconscious needs. Therefore, entering a movie theater is not unlike entering a dream. Films hypnotize us and take us to new worlds. Sleeping and films are like twin realities. And then there's also some stuff there that I think is a metaphor in terms of like his relationship to his homeland and to Thailand, because he talks about how sort of like sleep is an escape. Right. And so we talked a little bit last time about the turmoil in Thailand, the political turmoil and the censorship. And I reread this interview where he talks about at the time when his films were being censored, the censorship board was under the Ministry of Defense. Right. And so he was trying to appeal to the Ministry of Culture about this, to try and get his film shown as he intended. But he says like sleep is like an escape. It's a place you can go to, and you hope that the world, when you're sleeping, is a better place.
Wow. That's really beautiful. I love that quote from him about, you know, maybe movies fulfill a subconscious desire, of you know, like wakeful dreaming. That's so interesting. Cause I feel this is a personal project of mine. I feel that there is some sort of spiritual component to watching a movie, and I still don't quite understand that, but that kind of gets at that same idea that there's something that it's, I find them films personally moving more than most other art forms in general. And I think that there are times that I have a spiritual connection to a film, or I have a spiritual experience watching one. And anyway, so that just, I love hearing that from someone who is thinking the same things, and someone who's thought a lot more about it than I have. So that's really cool. Yeah.
Well, I think that spiritual connect, that idea comes up both in the Schrader book, the Transcendental Style in Film. Mm-hmm. And also there's a Susan Sontag essay about the aesthetics of silence that I think touches on that both sort of try to get at the idea that in film or in cinema, you can have these spiritual experiences. You know, they can take you places, these films can.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of a good segue into what I want to talk about next about the film, and that is the spirituality of it is really interesting. So with Uncle Boon Mee, I mentioned briefly just kind of, it's really interesting to step into another culture and kind of get a sense of, I don't know, the zeitgeist kind of around spiritual things and religion. And so in Uncle Boon Mee, we have the spiritual and the physical realms kind of coexisting in a way that's really interesting. And it's a religious tradition that's foreign to me. And so it's fascinating to learn more about it. And so we have like the ghost of his wife shows up, and we have his son who's a monkey ghost, and they just kind of show up and they're shocked for a moment, but then this is just part of what we're doing now. And then his wife's ghost also talked about the prayers and sacrifices that they had made kind of on her behalf, and how, yeah, I heard your prayers. I got the food you sent me. And that's like, it's, I can see how that might be like comforting in a way to a Thai viewer. I don't know. I don't want to put words in their mouth, but, that's it, just like almost confirming spiritual beliefs through film in a way, like, mm-hmm. let's play this out kind of thing. And so I think we have a similar thing happening in Cemetery of Splendor. One scene in particular is Jin goes to a shrine and she's praying to these two goddesses, and she puts up these animal tokens, and they kind of represent different things. And then a little bit later in the film, she's eating lunch and this young woman approaches her, and then this other young woman approaches her, and they start having this conversation, and then come to find out this is the two goddesses from the shrine, the statues that we had seen. And they're saying, we're those goddesses. We know the animals you gave us. We know the prayers you said. And we have some information for you. And they kind of tell her some information about the hospital. So again, just bringing in a spiritual tradition that I know nothing about, but then literalizing it in a way, was just really interesting to see. And I really liked that scene. And it's kind of I don't know, just a really shocking revelation when you like, oh, they're saying they're the goddesses. Wow. And there's like just a new level to what's going on. And also that's one of the first times in this one that I think like it feeling like it's grounded in reality kind of gets pushed a little bit in that scene. So I don't know. It's an interesting scene.
Yeah. And to me, what makes it work is that it's not presented as like being this fantastic thing. Right. Mm-hmm. It's everything is grounded. It's still very, just understated, you know.
Yeah, there's no special just like factor a or anything. Regular little park sitting at a picnic table kind of thing. Yeah.
But then unlike a lot of Western films where I feel like if somebody were to introduce this aspect and do it this way, the idea would be that you question the veracity of what's happening. But right. Here, I think you're just meant to accept that like, no, in this world, in the world of this film, these things are real.
Yeah.
Like these, they really are princesses, and people can really read minds and escape into dreams and see the past and things. It's just a part of the reality.
Yeah. Yeah. I should imagine like if Jesus walked into a scene all of a sudden, their characters would freak out. You know, it's like the only kind of parallel I can think of. But yeah, that's funny. Well, speaking of reading minds, I was going to talk about Kung. She's a character who is a pretty major part of it. Probably the second or third most main character. And she is a medium or a psychic of some kind. And so she can communicate through the sleeping soldier. So it seems like the soldier's spouse or someone is there, and she'll lay a hand on the soldier and then be able to communicate kind of what they're talking about. And that's a really interesting kind of setup. And again, it's also, as you're saying, like not seen as that unusual, at least in the context of the film. And so I think that's a question I have too, is for a Thai viewer, is this also a similar experience of, oh, wow, they are not finding this strange, or in their culture, would it just not be that strange to have a psychic person? You know, I don't know. I should probably do some research around that. But she ends up being a big part of the final sequence of the film, where basically she almost, she kind of embodies it, who has fallen back asleep, and he, they kind of like go on a date sort of thing. And it's a really interesting scene. It almost made me think of being John Malkovich. There's my John Malkovich reference. But in that movie, and I think in other things from Charlie Kaufman, he seems to be really interested in identity and the kind of identity swapping. And so in being John Malkovich, there's like characters can relate better if they're embodying a different character. Like if my soul is in John Malkovich, I have a better relationship with my spouse. It's kind of, if you've never seen that movie, that sounds really weird, but that's what it's about kind of, is kind of identity swapping and body swapping. And so it almost gave me that kind of a sense that made me want to rewatch being John Malkovich and rethink some of Charlie Kaufman's work now having seen this. And I don't know, it's kind of an interesting connection. But yeah, Kung's an interesting character and she does a lot of different things. Do you have any more thoughts about her?
Yeah. So one, it's also interesting looking at some deleted scenes. There's there's one scene that's deleted where she initially meets Jin and she reads her mind, and that is, it sort of validates that she has these abilities.
Yeah.
And I think that maybe initially Jen maybe is more skeptical or not, but in the film as it exists, you know, that's excised. But it's still never really questioned. And then that one scene that you mentioned towards the end where it has entered her body and he is speaking through her. Mm-hmm. I think that scene is kind of what made the film for me initially. Mm. It's just, and it goes back to something I mentioned last week when we talked about Uncle Boonmi, but the idea that there are these layers of existence throughout time in this singular space, right? Mm. So when it's in her body and he's describing the palace that was once there, or they're describing the graveyards that are now below their mm-hmm. feet. And then, you know, in the present day, there's a school there that is now a hospital but there's some construction going on. So soon there will be something else, or maybe not, because mm-hmm. we don't really know exactly what's going on with the construction. So all these layers of existence that are happening and depicted on the screen at the same time, wow. Everything sort of coexist. Right. Because even though right now they're in a hospital, or right now they're at a playground mm-hmm. or in a park, its experience in his dream world in that same location is this other plane of existence where this other structure exists.
Yeah.
It's all just simultaneously existing. And I think that's so interesting.
Yeah. That is really interesting. I had a quote that I read last week about, like, I guess William Wordsworth, who said that, we can remember heaven when we're born. As babies, we remember heaven. Yeah, so sort of like that idea of maybe time isn't as linear as we think, and that it's all happening at once. Yeah. And I think that the idea about the building, you know, once was a cemetery, now it's a school, now it's a hospital, that also ties back into reincarnation. And so maybe, mm-hmm. you know, if we're thinking about the relationship between the soul and the body, in Eastern religions, in reincarnation is a really common belief, and that maybe that's a good way to look at it. It's like, it's the same ground, but we have a new building or a new use for the building. So maybe it's the same soul, but different bodies. So yeah, that's a really interesting idea. And so that idea of past lives does come up several times in the film, so that's another tie back to Uncle Boonmi. But I think when we first meet, or early on, Kung tells that her experience when she realized she was a psychic was when she suddenly recalled a past life when she was young. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was an interesting, so here's her connection to Uncle Boonmi. But then it also is a big part of, so when Jin meets those goddesses, what they tell her is about the cemetery that was once under the hospital, and that there's all these kings buried there. Some ancient kings are buried there, and that the spirits of these kings are still fighting. And then she tells them that the soldiers are sleeping so much because the spirits are helping them fight. Like, the soldiers are helping the kings fight. And so that's kind of what it is describing in that final scene when he's like in the dream world, I guess, and explaining what's going on. But then there's some really interesting quotes when they were talking about that. So I think it's Jin who says, perhaps these soldiers were their soldiers in their past lives. So like the people who are sleeping in the hospital now, maybe these are the same soldiers who fought for these kings centuries ago, just now in their new lives. And then I think that also Jin says, that explains why when I was a student here in the school before it was a hospital, that explains why I felt so sleepy all the time. So it's like there's a just that presence in this building. I thought that was really interesting. And then there's also a line that I thought was just kind of oddly comic. She says, well, I'm happy to know that at least he's doing some good in his sleep. So it's like, he seems lazy by our standards maybe, but he's actually working really hard. And that's why these guys are all so sleepy, because their spirits are fighting with the ancient kings. So that's really an interesting thing. And, you know, maybe think about, I mean, these men had, when they were born, had no idea, right, that their past lives were soldiers. But almost like that kind of helps determine their destiny a little bit, or how interesting that a past life we have no idea about could suddenly affect us. And so that was kind of the connection of Pan's Labyrinth too, is that she just never felt comfortable in her skin a little bit, and then found out, oh, it's because I'm a princess from long ago, reincarnated. I don't know. It's an interesting thing. And again, I think it's just helping me, because I've known about the idea of reincarnation, but never really understood like why is that such a big deal? But this in those religious traditions, but this film is kind of really helping me to contextualize that and see it just baked into a culture and into a story. Yeah, it's just really interesting.
Yeah. There are a couple of things I want to touch on. I mean, not necessarily dwell, but one, just like, just as an aside, how funny the film is sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, like, there was something you mentioned and I chuckled when you said it, but now I can't remember what it was.
Happy to know he's doing some good in his sleep.
Yeah. But then also, you know, there's this scene where King is reading the mind of one of the sleeping soldiers for his spouse. And she's sort of asking him, what color should I paint the kitchen? And then I heard he was having an affair. Is that true? And that's, I mean, that's it's funny, you know? And then I was also just like taking just how much of this film is about memory, you know? Because like when Jen is sort of going through this school and saying like, I remember I used to sit over here. And I think she goes to the corner. I think it is in the corner where she says she used to sit and look out the window and think of the teacher, right? So like, there's just all of these things that are playing, going on, like with her sort of memory as her past life as a child, if you wanted to put it that way. I don't know if that's too cute or not, but, but yeah, there's so much going on in that it's just layered on top of each other.
Yeah. Yeah. She had a quote that I wrote down, I'm trying to find it, about, something about her memories. Yeah. She talked about a memory floating in her head and in her heart. And I just thought that was an interesting way to put that. And it kind of makes that connection to dreams, memories and dreams as kind of the things in our mental state that we don't quite understand, or they kind of elude us a little bit. And this film is really concerned with those parts of our minds. It's really interesting, I think. As far as like looking at like the spiritual realm stuff, this movie kind of seems to suggest that you can have like a healthy or an unhealthy relationship with the spiritual world. And so I think we get the opening shot of the construction happening. And so I think then we find out it's a cemetery nearby or maybe where they're digging. And so they're almost desecrating something and they're changing something holy there. And then you also have characters who, there's one point where Jin and It are eating in a park. And then a dog approaches them, and Jin is really kind to this dog and says, "Oh, do you want some food?" and all this. And then It is really kind of, he's not cruel, but he says, "Get out of here. Like, we're not giving you food." And she kind of chastises him playfully and like, "You should be nice." Or I think he says, "You're too kind to the dogs," which also reminded me of in Uncle Boon Mee, we had the aunt character who, part of the knock against her, like she's kind of a racist, she's got all these different things, also she really doesn't care about bugs, she kills bugs all the time, and so that's like a serious knock against her character. And so I think that's in a similar way it's saying, so kind of on the lines of that meditation scene where we're throwing our energy out into outer space and then drawing it back in, and it's sort of this interconnectedness of everything, that if you understand that, then you're going to be nice to dogs and you're going to be nice to bugs. And so I think that's an interesting idea that I've heard. I don't know. I think that sort of a notion is seen as hippie-ish or something in Western culture. But you know, I've heard similar things from different Christian writers, just coming at it from kind of a different angle. I think that's a Buddhist idea actually, is do the least harm, even to bugs. I was wondering about the different shots that are repeated about the ceiling fans and the water turbines, and so a lot of these are circular items, like we see like things going in a circle, and so I was like, why is it fixating on this so much? And I think that goes along with, you know, if time isn't linear, maybe time is more circular than we realize or that we often think about. And so it's giving us, you know, here's this really still shot of a ceiling fan for like, I don't know, what seems like 3 minutes. It's probably like 40 seconds, but some of these shots feel so long. Maybe that's also just because I was sleepy, but we have lots of different shots of circular motion. I think that is getting at the idea of reincarnation and these things move in cycles.
I guess it's weird because, so like, I mean, I'm not religious, but I find the topic is interesting when people who either are or were make some piece of art about it. So I think that's sort of where I get this interest in like Paul Schrader, right? Who's raised as a very devout and he sort of moved away from that as he got older, or Martin Scorsese, right?
Who, yeah.
I want to say there's an interview he gave where he's like, I'm going to hell or something like that. Like he just sort of, like, it's almost just like when you're raised in a very, like the very strict religious upbringing.
Yeah.
Even if you sort of move away from it, it's still a part of you, you know?
Yeah. So internalized. Yeah.
But I just think it's just sort of like that, you know, there's a lot in the, I've read the intro to the revised edition of Transcendental Film. There's a lot about sort of the way the stretching of time can sort of create space for introspection. And the viewer, and sort of just essentially it's sort of like, you know, when you have that shot of like the ceiling fan, that lasts for several seconds longer, or maybe I didn't time it, but it's on the screen for a long time.
Yeah.
And it just gives you as the viewer the chance to really think and ask questions like, what does this mean? Does it mean anything? What is happening? And so you as a viewer get to make these connections. And of course, in a film like this, sort of like what I talked about with Uncle Boomy when I watched some of the deleted scenes, is even though initially in the structure there are very specific things that are happening in the film, in the final form, they cut those things to give the viewer more space to make their own connections and do their own readings of the film, right? So he's not trying to give you answers. I also think it's interesting just that from what I've gotten from interviews with A Pitch Up Punk is that he himself isn't necessarily religious. He might be spiritual. He talks about meditation, but he doesn't seem to really believe the stuff about ghosts or spirits, but it's sort of part of Thai culture, so he includes it in the film. And so I'm not sure sort of where he is himself on the journey. And it's also a surprise because just a second ago I was curious, so I was looking something up to find that he's 50 years old and I imagine him younger. All of this stuff, there's a lot of different things going on there, and the spirituality is an aspect that I would like to pay more conscious attention to.
Yeah. Yeah. So as we talked about the circular motion and some of the shots and things, I guess we can look at some of the filmmaking just in general. Mm-hmm. So we have, as we mentioned, really long, slow shots in a lot of places. It seems like increasingly towards the end of the film, there's more and more of these, and there are... you mentioned just like shots of people out at the park and that sort of thing. There's one sequence of it's like nighttime, and it shows some people sitting by a river, and then it shows some people sleeping at a bus stop. And so it's kind of depicting sleep, like that's the human human aspect of sleep, people just sleeping. But then it also that was so like peaceful to me for some reason. It really was lulling me into trying to not go to sleep.
Did you notice at the bus stop that the light, like the color, the light, almost as though the lights from the hospital were on in some capacity because the color was changing, right?
Yeah.
Like at the bus stop. And so it's almost as so they were emanating out from the hospital over the whole town, which I think I noticed for the first time when I was rewatched it earlier today. And I also wondered, you know, if the people that it's depicting were homeless. Which is why, you know, they're sleeping in parks or a bus stop.
Yeah.
And to what extent this is sort of like a point of political commentary.
Right. Yeah.
Because the film itself is not explicitly political. It's subtle, but I do think that there's some tooth in there, right? Yeah. Like there's something going on.
Yeah. On that note. So I try to key into that a little bit after watching Uncle Boonmi and seeing some of the more explicitly political things there, I think. But there's some different just connection to the outside world talk. Like, so Jen's husband, this is her second husband, I think he's American, and we only see him for like a minute. But there's kind of some mentions of America and I think some other countries too. And at one point when they are setting up the sleep machines, someone says, well, these were used by American soldiers, so you know they must be good. But that was an interesting kind of
in Afghanistan.
Thing. Yeah. In Afghanistan, no less. Yeah. So then we have also there's just some interesting moments of capitalistic kind of things too. So there's the meditation scene, which I would not say, I'm not saying this about it, but there's sort of a parallel scene that where someone's selling some hand cream or something like that in the park. And it's almost like an infomercial. It just feels incredibly capitalistic. And then I think it's when Jen is talking to it about why he's kind of asking her, why would you marry an American man, and kind of poking fun at her for it. She says, you know, what I really wish, maybe this is a different conversation. At some point she says, I wish I had an American man, or Europeans have, or no, she's, I wish I had a European man. Europeans have all the money. And then the funny line was, Europeans are living the American dream. That's a funny way to put that. But so some kind of gentle poking at kind of capitalistic ideas a little bit. But then, yeah, so the soldiers themselves, you know, as I was thinking, are these going to be, is he going to make some kind of comment about the wars, not just that they've been fighting in or anything like that? I don't think we really get that. And in fact, if they're connected, he's kind of drawing a connection to the ancient kings that had soldiers fighting, and almost seeing it as a noble thing almost. It's kind of how I took it, but I don't know if I'm misreading that possibly, but yeah, the soldiers were an interesting part of that. The fact that they're soldiers is kind of interesting. And so there's like a PTSD element almost, that they, you almost expect that kind of suffering from a soldier, but then maybe there's something deeper, and then it's in the dream world, and that they're actually fighting for some sort of honorable cause.
Yeah. You know, with Uncle Boomy, there's the reference to the killing of communists. In this film, there's soldiers. We're not sure. It's never stated explicitly, yeah, what war, if any,
yeah,
they're fighting in, or if they, you know. But then there is, when they're doing the tour towards the end, we see a bomb shelter. Mm. And there are these statues or sculptures of people hiding in the bomb shelter. And so one of the things that I found is that a lot of what happens, or a lot of Jin's character, is taken from the actress. She has sort of worked as a collaborator with the Pichapong for 10 or 15 years. And this project was initiated, I guess, in the pre-scripting stage, when him asking her to sort of write a journal or a diary about her thoughts and things. And then so he incorporated a lot of that and a lot of his own background into it, because this is his first film that's actually made, that he made in his hometown, where he grew up, where his parents were doctors. And a lot of that is incorporated into the film. And so like the bunker is sort of is a reference to a childhood memory of Jinpira Pongpas, I think is how you pronounce her name, even though I think she has a married name now. But she described when she was 4 or 8 or 9, there was some conflict going on. People attacked the village. They went to the bomb shelter. They hid in there until the shooting stopped, and they came out and they saw that people had been shot. And she says that they weren't sure if it was the Vietnamese or the communists or who was doing the shooting, but it sort of is drawn from this traumatic experience from her life. And so I think there are, woven throughout the films, or those kinds of things, experiences that they had. And then there are scenes with a military figure that are cut out. And one of them, another character is there's a man in a military uniform with his button up shirt open, exposing his bare chest, and he's sort of combing the hair around his nipples before using scissors to cut the hair. And that was cut from the scene. And I don't know if it's because it was deemed too explicit, or because he was wearing a military uniform, or if it just didn't fit with the tone and the pace of the film. But there are a couple of scenes with that character that are cut. And I wonder if it's sort of to exploit or avoid explicit military iconography or allusions.
Huh, that's very interesting. I'll kind of only semi-related, but you mentioned last week we talked about the prince and how he's a big deal. There's a picture of him at one scene in like the cafeteria, so I noticed that as well, but it doesn't really seem to comment on it, but it's just there. So it's kind of interesting. But I did have a question. So at that kind of final scene, they kind of walk around this park. There's other statues they look at, but there's one shot. So I think it comes up twice almost. Like earlier in the film, we see it, and then we see it from a different angle of all these people coming and sitting by the river. But then they start just doing almost this dance of like trading places where they're sitting and moving in very like robotic, not natural ways. And I had no idea what to make of that. Do you have any thoughts about Do you know the scene I'm talking about?
Yeah. I don't know what that's about. It is an interesting film or an interesting scene. Every time I watch the film, I sort of forget that it's in there. But, you know, there's several benches and then people are sitting on them. And then someone will come and sit on an open one. And then someone else will get up and walk to another one. And it's almost like musical chairs. Yeah. But there's no, you know,
there's no music.
Music or anything yeah. signaling.
It feels like a musical suddenly. Like yeah. they choreographed this thing pretty tightly. Yeah.
And then I think it kind of comes up again in a shorter scene. I think we see that same area from a different angle and yeah. people are sitting. It kind of starts to happen again, but we don't stay with it as long. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's kind of vexing. I'm not yeah, quite sure.
I mean, the only thing I could think is it kind of shows several people within the confines of a shot and they're kind of moving around. And mm-hmm. I was like, is this sort of like depicting people walking through life and maybe trading places and like their souls are going to different places or something? That seems like a stretch and I don't really know. But that I was trying yeah. to think if there's any connection to the other things in the film. Is that possibly it? But I don't know. So if anyone has any thoughts on that listening, please email andrew@arthousegarage.com and let me know because I'm confused by it. But it's a really interesting shot and it's almost like fun to watch for a second because you're like, oh, wow, they're like being really intense about this. One other just filmmaking touch I wanted to talk about was the lighting of it. So there's a few moments in Uncle Boo and Me that I thought had really just kind of striking lighting. Usually that was like a single light source in the darkness kind of thing. And it's similar in this when we mentioned the sleeping machines, and that is the image that comes back again and again. And they're kind of like, it feels when you're in the room and it's dark and all those are on, it does feel almost dreamlike or otherworldly or something. So I think that's probably what he's getting at with that. Even though the machines themselves are kind of mysterious, are they like, maybe it's just a way to like give a physical depiction of sleeping and dreaming. Cause I think the lights are only on when they're asleep. But anyway, all that to say, the lighting is really striking in this. And I took note of that, but
there's a,
yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's not about those lights in particular, but there's this shot after they've gone to the movies.
Yeah.
Jen is going, she's gone back to the hospital school to a room that's been abandoned. And you just see this one beam of light. So presumably a flashlight as she's looking for the light to turn on. And you see this old school building in rubble with some sort of like propaganda poster or sign that's on the ground. But I remember just the lighting in that. Yeah. And also apparently the lamps themselves give off some sort of heat because I think it references that when he's asleep, he can feel the glow or the warmth of the lights.
Interesting. I just thought of, speaking of like the shots of circular things that we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. I just remembered towards the end, I'm trying to remember exactly what it is, but there's the shot. I think it's when they're leaving the movie theater and they have to go down an escalator, mm-hmm. but then in this mall that they're in, and then the camera kind of moves to where you can see a bunch of escalators all in one shot of this really tall, like shopping mall. And then it stays on that for a long time. And then it sort of fades so slowly that into another shot that it almost superimposes them for a long time. And I think it's the construction shot. There's the escalators superimposed over another shot.
Yeah.
And it holds that for a long time. And so the escalators, I think maybe that gets back to that same idea of circular motion, that things are always moving, and that whether that's our souls being reincarnated or a building being reused or just how everything is connected, it's kind of showing that continual motion because the shot is really still, but there's a lot of motion within the shot. But
yeah, I think the camera only moves once in the whole film.
Yeah.
And it's towards the very end, you know, every shot is static.
Yeah.
There's no music except for the street music and mm-hmm. at the very end.
Yeah. That there's like a dance at the end and then the music kind of carries on, mm-hmm. which is very similar to the ending of Uncle Boo and Me, the way the music, the diegetic music kind of went on into the credits sort of, and maybe wasn't just diegetic at the end. Yeah. That's really interesting. The only other thing I really wanted to say about this movie is kind of on the way it was kind of moving was really that final scene where she is, Jin is with, she's with it, but it is in the body of Kung, and they are, like on this, yeah, kind of on this date, walking through the park, looking at the statues, and it really gets just so, so oddly romantic, that mm-hmm. it really was kind of sweet. Like there's a moment when they look at, a statue of two like lovers holding hands. And then it's almost like a visual joke, but then and it's shocking because they look at the statue for a long time, like, oh, how nice. And then the camera, I think this is the one time the camera moves, maybe. So we see this the statue of the lovers, and then, or maybe it just cuts, but I think it might move over. It pans over, and then you suddenly see that there's another identical statue, except they're skeletons. So these two skeletons mm-hmm. holding hands, sitting on a bench. And it in the context of this movie, thinking about I don't know, life and death and reincarnation and all the circular motions at seeing two skeletons holding hands was weirdly really sweet. And it kind of got at just the connections people can have, amidst this crazy world and who even knows what's going on in the spiritual world. Right. And it seems like Jin and it have what seems like a romantic connection. That was my feeling about it. I don't think it's ever really explicit, but there seems to be some flirting. And then in that end date scene, even though it is in a different body, they have this connection. And kind of the way that scene ends, I don't know, it'd be a spoiler exactly. I won't say exactly what happens, but Jin has had this leg injury the entire film. And then basically King, who is embodied by it, does something to kind of sort of help heal that. And it's pretty sensual, I would say. So I wanted to see, do you agree with that reading? I really felt like this is kind of romantic in its own weird way. But yeah, what did you think about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm not sure that I ever read it as romantic. Mm. It is sensual. And it, like the relationship is interesting in that I think it's not familial, it's not strictly platonic, but I don't think of it as being romantic. But I could be wrong. I don't know, maybe if I watch it a fourth time
I may be way off base, but that was my my feeling with it.
But the thing is, like to me, like that scene is, it's more tender, right? Yeah, it's sweet. Mm-hmm. and it's and this idea of like trying to heal her, or at least cause her some comfort. And of course, I think that's the first time in a film, I can't remember if in Uncle Boomy, we actually see her leg, but you know, the actress, she does have a pronounced limp and it's from a motorcycle accident that she had, in 2004, I think, she fell off her motorcycle in the rain.
Wow. I didn't know that. So that's a real injury we were seeing.
Yes. I mean, she also, cause she also has that limp in, Uncle Boomy, and so she, you know, I think she is scheduled to have some sort of surgery because there is a corrective surgery. She mentions it in the film too, the corrective surgery that she can have.
Wow.
That's quite expensive, but she might be able to afford it now that she's starred in several films.
That's so interesting. Like that adds another layer of like personal vulnerability to that scene then too, that knowing that that's really her leg injury that we saw there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really, really interesting.
Yeah, I know she said that when they filmed that, she thought that that scene, well, we're not trying to spoil, but she says she felt sad and touched at the same time, you know, and because it does require a level of vulnerability to shoot that.
Yeah, it's another one of those long, drawn-out shots, too. It seemed like it went on for quite a while. And then from there to the end of the movie is, I don't know, maybe like 10 minutes, but there's only like two or three shots, I think, in that whole thing. Some really long shots of people dancing in the park, and then... Yeah. So that really feels like that's the end of the movie, more or less. I think there's a little bit more conversation with him in the hospital too. I just remembered, but
yeah,
that's sort of the climax. Well, you know, I think. Go ahead.
Well, so they also have the conversation where I forget exactly how she says it, but she says that she wants to see, she doesn't want to be asleep or something like that. And then it through King's body says that you just have to open your eyes like this, real wide like this. And that's also how the film ends.
That's right. Know? That's right.
With her sitting on the park bench with her eyes open as wide as they can be, watching the children play over this construction area that is also a cemetery that is going to be something else. You know, there are all these, again, this is the layers of time.
Yeah, like life and death and a new life with these children. Mm-hmm. And yes, yeah, seeing all of that at once. And that's maybe the circular motion of that. Yeah, wow. Well, that is really interesting. I wanted to mention a couple other just kind of comparisons or connections to Uncle Boon Mi. And that, so you mentioned last time that Peachit Pong likes to really connect his filmography, even to so far as having like the same actor play the same character seemingly in two different movies, or just slightly different names. You mentioned of one of the characters. There were some things here that felt very familiar. Actually, the first shot we see of the bed, of the soldier laying in a bed in the corner of that room, looked just like Uncle Boon Mi's bed, which we spent so much time with, with his dialysis machine and all of that. Like, I don't know if that's just what Thai beds look like, but it seemed like the set was very similar, similarly dressed and all of that. So that was one point of connection. But then, and then all the talk of past lives, of course, which I think we've probably covered that pretty well. But then, as I kind of mentioned before, at the beginning, I did feel that this was a little bit more accessible, a little bit more straightforward, less abstract, I think is the word you used, than Uncle Boon Mi. And I think that visually it was somehow easier to connect as well. And I think that's probably because I think this was shot on digital, whereas Uncle Boon Mi was shot on film. And there's just something that feels more modern about it. And it's probably on me. That's my bad, that a more modern film feels easier to connect with. But I think that's probably not uncommon either. But I believe this. Can you confirm or deny that this was shot on digital?
I'm going to say that it was, because I remember reading a quote where Hal originally he liked the idea. He's not committed to one format or the other, but he realized that there was no reason to hold on to film.
Yeah.
And I think in the quote, he says something like, for a young kid that has no experience, it doesn't mean anything. And so, you know, it's all sentimental. Mm. And so there's no need to hold on to it.
Interesting.
And so I'm pretty sure this is shot digitally.
I remember seeing that Uncle Boon Mi was one of the, just generally, there's not a lot of movies shot on film anymore. And that was like a significant thing about it, that it was. And I think it did give it kind of an old school feeling in some ways, especially like thinking about the princess scene that was, you know, set what, centuries ago, probably. Something about that adds like a level of a feeling of authenticity or something to it. Right, yeah, it almost, so that was made in 2010. Feels like it could have been made in the 70s or something because of its its look a little bit. But this one felt more modern, and we're in a more of a bustling area. Like, it doesn't seem like a huge city, but there's a lot more just people in this one. And so I think something about that is a little bit more easy to grasp onto. So all that to say, if you watched Uncle Boon Mi and you thought, I never want to watch another movie by this guy, maybe give this one a try, because you might find more to connect with it. I definitely did. Although I definitely want to revisit Uncle Boon Mi having seen this. Cause I don't know if it's just having some context for a Peachit Pong style, but this second film from him, I definitely connected with it more and really had a enjoyable experience with it.
I would say actually start with this one.
Yeah. Which seems counterintuitive, maybe, but yeah.
I think the first film of his that I saw was Syndromes in a Century. Then I saw this, and then Uncle Boon Mi. And I do, in the first time, Uncle Boon Mi also, you know, left me cold, and I'm still not as warm to it as I am to this film. But if, you know, for some reason, Uncle Boon Mi is the one, if you're on Twitter, that kind of comes up the most, especially in meme formats. There's one person I follow in particular that loves to meme.
I need to see
the title
that.
Of the film.
And it won more awards too, just, I think. Like it won the Palme d'Or and all that, yeah.
But this one, you know, I think he said this is his most personal film because it is shot in his hometown, and it depicts sort of like the core aspects of his growing up. So, you know, his parents worked in the hospital, so that was like his home. The cinema... Actually, I have a quote here. Yeah, and the school, you know, the three places where, you know, he spent the most time, the cinema, the hospital, and the school. And so much of that is woven into the fabric of the film. Mm-hmm. And so, and it's also, like, to me, just a wonderful piece of pure collaboration, because so much of it is made up of both aspects of his life and his memory in this place.
Mm, yeah.
And Jinjira is from not from the same town, but from very close by. And so they have these sort of similar experiences growing up. And then also the language, it's in a dialect specific to this particular province. So, like, it's even within Thailand, there are subtitles, right?
Because
the language is different enough that people from Bangkok may not necessarily understand the language.
There's a little conversation about dialect at some point too that kind of keys into that. But yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just love that. Like, it's almost like a foreign film within a foreign film.
Yeah. Wow. That's interesting. Yeah. I don't think there's really an American equivalent to that. I mean, maybe in, like, England, there would be, like, just in a Western context, because there's so many different dialects or different areas there. So I studied abroad in Liverpool, and the Liverpool accent is widely regarded as, like, almost unintelligible. And it took a long time before I could really understand people speaking English to me. But yeah, and then actually, so I spent time in China, and it's similar there. I spent a year teaching there, I mentioned last time, because then I went to Thailand for a few weeks, where there's that dialect are so far ranging that, you would literally need subtitles in the way you're talking about, with different things in different areas. But yeah, that's really interesting. So if they have a conversation about dialects, and he tries to speak in her dialect, I think, at one point, so there's kind of a connection there. She speaks English for just a second, actually, too, which was surprising. I had the subtitles turned on, so I was just reading along, and then I was like, wait, is that what she said that I just understood? That's kind of a funny experience. I guess she's talking to her American husband for a moment there.
Yeah. But that seems funny, too.
Yeah, it's really odd.
Well, it's funny because she says something like, you know, I told you about him. He fights for his country. You would understand. And he's like, he's very, I get it. He's patriotic. And it's just,
yeah.
That scene, I think, is also very funny.
Yeah, and it's an important one.
He seems sweet.
Yeah, he seems like a nice guy. And we see him dancing in the park for a moment, kind of out of place, but seemingly knowing quite a bit about the culture, you know, if he's praying at a shrine and all of that. But that's an important scene, because that's what the goddesses then point back to when they meet her. So, yeah, it's an interesting little moment there. Well, do you have any other kind of final thoughts before we wrap up? I think this has been a really fruitful discussion.
I'm just going to say that people should watch this film, watch all of his films that you can get your hands on, as much as, and it's okay to fall asleep.
Yeah.
As he said, it's okay to fall asleep if you feel the need.
Yeah. That's he's the one filmmaker I've ever heard of that kind of almost wants you to on some level. Yeah. So as I mentioned, I did fall asleep right at the end. I usually don't stay up quite so late watching movies, but I was like, I'm going to finish this out. And I fell asleep. And so then I ended up rewinding it and kind of rewatching the ending part. So I don't know if this was the magic of the film, but I slept really hard. I went to bed right after that and had a lot of dreams actually too, which I don't always. So
did you write them down?
Maybe there's something on it. I didn't. I can vaguely remember now. I did have some really vivid dreams just a couple days after watching Uncle Boon Me too, actually, that I did write down. So maybe there's something to this. Maybe if you want to, like, start dream journaling, maybe this is the way to do it. Watch We Were Sathical Films, and then you'll start having vivid dreams. They weren't like lucid dreams or anything, but just more dreams than I usually have. Well, we can wrap it up there. Thank you so much, Amaya, for joining me again. And I'm excited for next time, when we are going to look at Bong Joon-ho and The Host, which is one I've not seen. And I'm excited to see a little change of pace, moving from a Thai director to a Korean director. And I think a lot of people listening have probably seen Parasite, because it was such a big deal last year, and it's so great. I am excited to look back in time a little bit at Bong Joon-ho's past work. So watch The Host if you can get your hands on it. Speaking of, really quickly, streaming, if you wanted to try to stream either of the films we've talked about so far, Uncle Boon Me is on the Criterion Channel and a few other places. And then Cemetery of Splendor, I initially had trouble finding. I ended up streaming it through Amazon. So, I mean, if you're looking for it right at this moment, and hopefully it'll stay there for some months, but it's through Amazon, through one of their channels, the Strand releasing channel, which I think it's $5 a month, or you can do a free week. So I did my free week, and I'm going to try to watch a few more things on it. But this one is streaming there. It's also, you can get it from the library. I also got the disc from the library. So I always want to plug local libraries when I can, because you can get almost anything through the library. It's great. So as far as the host is concerned, I think it is actually through Hoopla, which is one of those library streaming services. And you can also rent it online. But yeah, have a look at that, and we will discuss that next time. If you want to support Art House Garage, you can leave a rating or review on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you are using. And you can keep up with Art House Garage on social media. We are at Art House Garage almost everywhere, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Letterboxd. And you can also find video reviews on YouTube and reviews and event coverage on the blog at arthousegarage.com. You can email me at andrew@arthousegarage.com, and you can subscribe to the monthly email newsletter at arthousegarage.com/subscribe. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, keep it snob free.